Welcome back. I just wanted to mention another one of George Norrie's live events coming up, this one in Scottsdale, Arizona. This is another Danheiser Wagner Entertainment production, George Norrie Live at the Virginia G. Piper Theater in Scottsdale. That's Saturday, April the 21st, 5 to 8 p.m. And here's the lineup, folks. Get a load of this. Spirit Traveler, Sonia Grace, astronomer and master of all things space, Dr. Sky, Steve Cates. They'll end the evening with a UFO roundtable featuring some of the most respected people in ufology today. Dr. Lynn Kitai, of course, from the Phoenix Lights, Melinda Leslie, and Travis Walton. John D'Souza. George will then he'll sing a few songs with a live band, and you can take part in a Q&A with each guest. Don't miss out. You know tickets will go fast. Call the box office straight away at 480-499-8587, 480-499-8587, and you can order online tickets at scottsdalearts.org, scottsdalearts.org. Oh, there'll be a meet and greet following the show. Hey, coming up next, psychic Sloan Bella talks about her spirit communication with the likes of Rita Hayworth, Jimi Hendrix, Kurt Cobain, and her experiences as the last psychic to the late Anna Nicole Smith, how she experienced Anna's death prior to it happening, and the subsequent haunting of her home by her one-time client, Anna Nicole. That's all coming up on Coast to Coast AM. Sloan Bella began her career on the streets of Toronto working with missing and exploited children. By the age of 17, Sloan was established as a professional psychic medium. While deeply entrenched in the street music vibe, reading for everyone from Gregory Hines to Don Adams, along with a large clientele that included street kids, runaway teenagers, teachers, musicians, businessmen, actors, strippers, congressmen, housewives, athletes, and anyone who needed help. Sloan's abilities at one point were even sought after by the head of a major crime family. Sloan was always connected to the other side, and one of the most unusual connections was her mediumship communication with the late Jimi Hendrix, who guided her and aided her working on the streets of Toronto and Hollywood as a street psychic with intuitive guidance to runaway and sexually exploited children. Great pleasure to welcome back to Coast AM, Sloan Bella. Hey, Sloan, how are you?
Hi, I'm good. How are you, Richard?
Terrific, thanks. What have you been up to since we talked, I guess, last June?
Yeah, well, time flies when you're having fun. Lots of stuff, lots of different stuff with this psychic community. Been working on some projects and basically really trying to get into my work more so that I can expand my abilities.
I'm intrigued by this head of the crime family that you worked with. I don't imagine you're going to reveal any names, but can you?
He's since passed away. I'll give you that hint.
Ah.
He died in jail, and yeah, when I was probably 19, if I'm thinking back correctly, I was hired to work for one of his business establishments in Florida. It's after I'd moved to Los Angeles, and oddly enough, I was hired because I'm not sure that they believed necessarily in psychics or mediums, but the men in that family used to date women other than their wives, and it was the mistresses who loved the psychics. So we were hired to actually read for the other women that these men were dating that were not their wives. And we kept those women happy. There was a few of us that used to do it, and I got out of Florida at the time just before he was brought up on federal charges, actually. I kind of knew that was going to go down because there were other people that used to come in for the reading, so it was very intense. I will say that playing dumb blonde actually helped me at that time because I didn't think anybody thought that I had any actual information that could get them into trouble, so it was kind of a benefit to not act too intelligent at the time and just kind of mosey on out of there. So that's what I did. But it was very interesting. And years later, one of the people connected to that crime family who actually helped bring the head guy down relocated to Los Angeles and actually, weirdly, had believed in my work, surprisingly had not been murdered by them, but had believed in the work that I did and sent many of the girls that were working in, you know, the professional sex industry to me as clients, and that would have been in the early 2000s. So that came around again, which was quite interesting.
The last time you were on with me, Sloan, in June, we talked about your spirit communication with Jimi Hendrix. Now that started when you were working, when you yourself were homeless on the streets of Toronto.
Truthfully, it started before I ran away from home. So I was about 12, and we were discussing, you're a huge music buff, which I love. We were discussing that, and he was coming through to me just prior to my leaving home. Huge connection with him and homeless kids and street kids and wanting to, I'll say, advocate for them to be okay or trying to steer them. I felt a really strong connection. I had no clue who he was at the time. I just thought he was my friend, which is a strange thing to say, but just my pretend friend. So I did not know who he was till several years later. But as I was saying, it was very interesting because he was continually popping into my consciousness, and his energy was very, very big. So he was dynamic. So it was like an apparition used to appear in front of me, and he was constantly writing and playing music. So I knew later on when I came to analyze it that he actually had died before he was, of course, ready to, which means I don't feel like he died exactly the way that they said he did. And he also had a lot of unfinished work. So a lot of his musical creations were not completed, and he was actually really trying hard to get somebody to pick up on that. Now, I could pick up on his energy, but I was completely dumb when it came to creating music. So he found me. He knew I could communicate with him. He could see the energy, but I was unable to actually write the music down. I was writing the music, but I didn't really know what I was doing, and it didn't make sense to me, so I just kind of blew that off. He was somebody who was trying to get anybody who could hear him to create what he couldn't create because he'd passed through his body, passed on to the other side. So it was really interesting. It taught me a lot about how people communicate. He was one of the strongest, most vivid people that I've spoken to, very dynamic in personality.
How did you finally piece together that your imaginary friend was Jimi Hendrix?
Well, what was so interesting, I know, so strange, right? I'm like, yeah, there's this guy and he looks like this and, you know, whatever. But I was actually in Toronto and I was down on Yonge Street. You're familiar. I know this. And there was a cover band or a tribute band to Jimi Hendrix. And I happened to pop in to watch this band. I probably was 16 or 17. And I completely was like, that's who it is. And maybe I was like 16, somewhere in there. But I was like, that's who it is. And then I was like, oh my gosh, had no idea. And I wasn't the only one picking him up. There were a lot of street kids that he popped up to, and in particular, kids that were not living at home and were on the street and kind of in danger. There was nothing salacious about the way that he communicated. It was almost as if it was comforting. He was like always there. He was peripherally always there. I felt his presence constantly for many years. And again, by the time I picked up on him, he'd been dead for, I think, 72 or early 70s. And so I'm talking early 80s at this point. And he's still coming through, which just shows you just because somebody dies, they don't immediately like cross over, reincarnate, and go on somewhere else. Sometimes they have unfinished business here, and he was one of those people. But it had to do with the fact that he left before he got to say what he wanted to say. So I feel people are constantly trying to say what he wanted them to say. I don't feel anybody succeeded as of yet, which is interesting. I feel like the energy is still trying to get us to hear what he was trying to say.
Right, right. I seem to recall when you were on last, somebody called in familiar with Jimi Hendrix's work, and he mentioned a musician who plays in another band who was hospitalized.
Canadian band, yes.
Yes.
He was on your Twitter, yeah.
And he talked about this musician in this band who was hospitalized, had some sort of a mental breakdown, and believed that he was being, I don't know, not possessed, I don't think that's the right word, but by the spirit of Jimi Hendrix. Do you remember that?
Yes,
remember that call?
And it was I do remember that call, yes. And he said, the band musician, I think it was a Canadian band too. Don't quote me on that, though, but I just remember the connection. He'd been hospitalized. Yeah, that was Jimmy trying to get through to him. What that man, what that musician was, is a medium, and Jimmy was trying to get through to connect because he would be the perfect person because he's a songwriter, musician. So that would make sense to me. And see, when they're on the other side, they're not looking at us like, oh, if I communicate with her, she's going to have a nervous breakdown and end up in the hospital. what they're thinking is, oh, I can communicate with her, so let me try to connect with her. And how we process it as people is so individual and so unique and so different, depending on how our body's wired, how our chemistry's wired, how we process things intellectually, and basically if we're open to experience it or do we shut it down. So it's kind of hit and miss with them on the other side, even if we are open psychically. And it can drive people who know what they're doing crazy on top of it. It can make them nutty at the same time. So that's why he locked himself, took himself into a hospital. But I do remember that call. It was really great validation for the fact that he was out trying to get people to write his music for him.
Well, someone who's listening that night will remember and call in, or maybe that same caller will call in to remind us who that was. But you said that Jimi Hendrix is still coming through to you, even to this day?
Well, he comes through periodically. It's not as consistent as it was. The energy of him comes through. I feel like there's still information about his passing that he wants people to understand. And I feel it's really interesting because I feel like it keeps coming up. About 2 years ago, he was very strong around me, and I feel like it's coming up again. So when I think of his energy, when I ask, I don't actually see him the same way. That's faded because he was so, I could touch him. There's a few people I've seen when they cross over where it feels like you could say, let me touch that. It's almost like it's behind a sheet, but it's close enough that you could reach out and touch the person. With him, I'm just getting the impression that his story will come out again. They keep wanting to do a story. So somebody on the other side, including himself, but somebody else, regardless of where he is, because I don't feel him close to our energy field here, so I do feel he's gone on. And it's not that they don't go on when they communicate with us. It's that they can choose energetically to move through time and space. I don't think I understand it fully, or I don't think we understand it fully, but it's as if he still wants his story spoken about. So that's what's going on. I feel like he's trying to get people to pay attention to his story. So there's definitely something unsettled about the way he passed. I feel it again. I feel it's more of a negligent type of passing, as in people turned a blind eye and walked out. I don't feel he should have died, although he did die. So technically he probably should have died because he did, but I don't feel that it had to be that outcome. I feel like they turned their back and walked. So I feel like he was in the company of others when he passed.
And well, that would have been his girlfriend, Monica Daneman, at the time, who, and he was staying at her apartment in London. And that's, I think the story was when the ambulance attendants arrived, on September 18th, 1970, the apartment was empty except for Jimi Hendrix, who appeared to be already dead on the bed, fully clothed. And Monica Daneman, I believe, later told police that she had left and gone out to buy a pack of cigarettes. So there you are. There is a lot
I feel like he isn't settled with that. His energy isn't. I don't think it bothers him. It's not like a, quote, murder, but it was negligent. And I think when the soul sees themselves pass and realizes what they could have created, in his case, it would be creation-wise. Keep in mind, this man was extremely ahead of his people. Like, we haven't even met the likes of anybody like him as far as how he was creating his music. And he had a connection directly to the other side. That's how he was able to create it. So he was an open channel himself. So for him to realize he could impart that on this side of the veil and actually end up crossing over and not being able to complete it would probably make the soul a little bit unsettled. And that's kind of the energy that I still get. So it's like he wants people to know that he wants people to understand that he didn't do this to himself purposely. This was something that could have been avoided and he would have continued. So there's some shame connected to the idea that he passed before he did what he should have done. In his mind. I'm not saying in our mind, but I mean, we're also upset about it because can you imagine all these years later, the beautiful stuff he would have created?
I know. I believe since he died, they've released at least, must be a half a dozen albums that he recorded, before his death. He had such a backlog of material. There's probably still more to come. What about Kurt Cobain?
Yes.
You've contacted his spirit, or how did that happen?
Oh, poor Kurt. I have a real affinity for him, as a lot of people do. Basically, now his energy is a little bit different than your traditional, not that every suicide is different, I guess, when somebody chooses to take their own life. His is a little bit interesting. He, too, is an open channel. So the information that he got, now, I think I didn't hear your first guest all the way through, but I would say this ties in with the drug theme of that. When Kurt Cobain was growing up and was put on these drugs that our society gives to little kids that are hyper when they should actually be hyper and running around, but we don't like it in school. Anyway, when they put somebody on the drugs like that and they happen to be very open energetically, it really tends to corrupt their circuits. And I think that that's what happened to him. That was the impression I got. So I got the impression months before he passed away. Of course, he had the drug addiction on top of, you know, whatever was fed to him as a child. But months before he passed away, I feel as if he was being energetically compromised by voices or spirits around him that wanted him with them on the other side and not here. I got that really clearly after he passed, that this was something that, okay, I'm going to word it to you in a very strange way. Forgive me for saying this, but I almost feel like the soul, you can't really murder the soul because the soul lives on, but I feel as though the energy was murdered and convinced to leave the body. So this is somebody that is not in a right frame of mind. I'm speaking energetically, not from the drugs, okay? So energetically, not in a right frame of mind. And so when because they're an open channel, entities, spirits, people with nefarious thinking, if you will, can connect to them. And I feel like he was listening to a lot of that. I almost feel like he was being berated energetically or verbally convinced to do this. So I feel as if he took his own life, not of his own free will, if that makes sense. I don't know if I'm explaining that right, but that's how it felt to me when I communicated with him. Like this was something that he did not choose to do, but thought he had to do because they told him to do it.
He was being manipulated in some way.
Yes, manipulated because his energy was so fragile and so heightened. Understand when you're that open, and then let's say on top of it, you're on drugs and you are depressed and you have all of those things, because I think he had a, if I'm correct, I think he probably had a major drug habit in every drug, but I think it was a heroin habit at the time. If you're really, really open, every time you do drugs at that extreme, you open the aura, like opening your front door and letting everybody in. And so you never know what's going to show up. And I feel like that's what happened to him. But I'll even extend it further and say that months before his death, because I can hear the people chattering to him. So it's like he couldn't shut off his mind. And I would say it's a little bit like when somebody describes being schizophrenic, but I don't think he was that. Like the voices were constantly on him. I feel it's because he was open. What he probably should have done is talk to somebody, maybe like a shaman or somebody who could have closed the energy around his body to shut it down, to give him time to rest, to recuperate, so he could really think about what he was hearing. That's how I feel about it with him. So I feel it was a really unfortunate chain of events for him. And the second, and by the way, what I picked up with him, I don't actually know if I don't think I've read this, but what I picked up with him is he did not die right away. He stayed lingering here. And that was even worse because I can feel the recognition of, I don't want to be in this position and I don't want to be over there. I want to be back here. So there was an immediate feeling of, you know, why am I stuck here? Almost like being paralyzed, but I'm speaking again energetically. And that was kind of terrifying when I felt that. That was a very terrifying feeling.
You mentioned, you know, he couldn't shut his mind off. How about for you when you're receiving these communications from, you know, these spirits? Are you able to shut it off? Do you want to shut it off?
It's thing. I choose to ignore things. I like to do that quite a bit. when I hear something, I'll often shout across the room, you know, shut up. I don't want to talk to you. Or, you know, I can see you. I hear you. I acknowledge them. And then I don't. That goes on quite a bit, and there's nobody in the room, but they're trying to let me know that they're here. But it has at different points, and this way, the stronger the person's energy is on the other side, and when I connect to it, if it's a extremely intense energy, and I get enmeshed in their energy, so I merge with it. I don't quite know how to explain it, but it feels to me as if I stepped into their body literally. So,
all right, listen, sorry, Sloan, I'm going to jump in here because we're going to head on into a break. And I think I'm going to try to get you maybe set up with a different phone. You're kind of phasing in and out on us. We'll take care of business on the other side. Van Morrison, Bright Side of the Road, right here on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back. Sloan Bella, psychic medium, my guest. We'll get back to more of that conversation, and we'll open up the phone lines at the top of the hour for questions and comments. Egyptian archaeologists have discovered a mummy in one of two previously unexplored tombs across the Nile from the southern city of Luxor, according to the Antiquities Ministry. The tombs were found in the 1990s by German archaeologist Frederica Kamp, though she had only reached the entrance gate but never entered, according to the ministry. It said that both tombs, which were given numbers by Kamp, were likely to date back to dynasties of the New Kingdom, which lasted several centuries until about 3,000 years ago. Since Kamp's discovery, both tombs were left untouched. An Egyptian archaeological mission started work. Antiquity Minister Khalid El Enani was in Luxor to announce the discovery in Draa Abul Naga, a necropolis near the famed Valley of the Kings, where many pharaohs, including Tutankhamun, were buried. And you can read more of that story in the news section, where our webmaster tonight, Greg Bishop, has posted it up at coasttocoastam.com. Nine seasons, nearly 300 episodes. Hard to imagine, hard to believe. It's beyond belief. George Norrie's streamed television show. And you can join George for dynamic discussions on paranormal phenomena, conspiracies, and all things unexplained. You can start watching episodes right now. Just visit beyondbelief.com. Sloan Bella on the other side, here on Coast to Coast AM. We are back with Sloan Bella here on Coast to Coast AM, psychic medium. Sloan, you've been described as a metaphysician. What is that exactly?
Well, in reference to that, that is a person who studies all forms of metaphysical things. So in every avenue, not just one thing. So, for example, I'm not just a psychic or just medium or tarot card reader. I study all forms of metaphysical things, so all forms of the occult. I'm well versed in it and continue to learn and study throughout my life. So it's somebody that learns the principles of metaphysics, as opposed to just, for example, like, oh, I can pick up on dead people or psychically predict the future. That would be the difference. That's how I like to describe it.
All right. Would that include being a medical intuitive? Do you do that as well?
Yes, I do get that with people. Certain people ask, and I will feel their issues in my body. So, and my favorite thing to explain to people is when women come in for readings and they sit down in front of me, if they happen to be ovulating, I'm going to feel that. And I always will ask them, are you ovulating or are you getting, you know, is it your time of the month? And because I will literally feel it and it'll feel like it's happening to me. Or I'll feel it in the area of the body. When I'm also looking at people, their auric energy changes color if there's disease in the body. So when somebody has, and it becomes very murky the more of a problem they have. So think of a very vibrant color, and then think of it going down the color spectrum to a very dull and murky and kind of muddy color. When I see colors like that around somebody, I know that there's an issue going on. And I say the other side will usually direct me to which part of the body that's on. So I'll see it, like if I'm looking at you and I'm looking at your left shoulder and I see a color that's murky, I'll know that it's that part of your body. I may not necessarily know what it is, but I'll know that you have to deal with it and I'll know that it's that area. So it kind of works that way for me. It really does. Our bodies really do tell on us what's going on, not only with how we feel, but how they vibrate, like how we look to other people. You can really see it if you pay attention to it.
Anna Nicole Smith, you were her last, she was a client of yours, and you were her last psychic.
Yes.
Tell me, how did that come to be?
Well, she was quite interesting. That actually came to be through one of my other client's girlfriends who worked with Anna Nicole and was with her and actually was the one that dressed the body for burial. So I was introduced to Anna through her, and it was interesting because it was during the time that her son had passed. So it was in the later part of her life. And it was very, very intense because of what had happened to her. She had the birth of her daughter and the death of her son, like boom, boom, right back to back. And so she was wanting to understand what had happened. Of course, there's no way to really tell somebody what happened in that instant. But prior to her actual passing, what happened, because we would communicate and talk about this, and I somehow, unbeknownst to me, got hooked into her energy, and I didn't realize that it was her that I was experiencing. But for approximately 5 months before she passed, I think her daughter was born in September, and I believe she passed the following February, or February or March, somewhere around there, just right after her daughter's birth. But what was happening to me is I was having these issues, and my family probably thought that I was really, really insane and needed to be locked up myself. But I would look at my body, and I would see, and it was always my right leg, and I would see my right leg as being really huge and having like an infection in it at the top. This was in my head, okay? I didn't actually have an infection, but I thought I did. So I would go downstairs, and I would say to my husband, you know, can you see my legs bigger, and I think it's swollen and I have an infection. And we would take out the camera and he would snap pictures of my legs so that I could actually see it in the camera, so that I could see that that wasn't actually what was happening. So this went on for several months, and there were several times where I was out with another friend of mine who was a medium, and we were at a hospital in Hollywood, and it occurred to me that I was dead, even though I wasn't dead, but it occurred to me that I was dead. So I felt like I could walk out into traffic because nobody could see me anyway. And she had to actually pull me in off the road. And I said,
oh, my.
Yeah, no, she did. She said, you're not actually dead. She said, what are you doing? I said, well, I'm dead. They can't see me. I felt like I was actually dead. And then after that happened, and this went on, this was closer to Christmas. After that went on, I started to wake up in the middle of the night. And I got extremely worried about my kids. My kids were teenagers at the time. So I would go and check on them to see if they were breathing and inevitably wake them up, you know, seeing if I could feel their breath. And they're like, what are you doing? And I thought my children were missing. So that was another thing that happened. And this went on, and it went on from the blood infection I thought I had to the swollen legs to the fact that people couldn't see me because I was dead. And on Christmas Eve, very vividly, I remember this. I was up in my room and I was looking in the mirror, you know, probably midnight after wrapping presents. And I was like, I can't see myself. So I kept staring in the mirror. And then it occurred to me that all the skin had fallen off my face and that there were just bones. And I started saying to my husband, I can't put the makeup on my face because I don't have any skin on my face. It's just bones. I don't understand. And I thought I was dead again. Okay. So this went on and on and on. Now, on the day that Anna Nicole passed, I got a phone call from her friend that was with her. I think it was in the Bahamas or Bermuda. I always get them confused. Anyway, I got a phone call that she had passed, like right at that moment that that happened. I think she was in Miami, but anyway, the person that was taking care of the body after that had called me at the moment that she passed, and I still was having these issues. A week later, when they finally released the body for the funeral, I got a phone call from that person telling me it can't be an open casket. They left the body out. The skin fell off her. It's just bones. I can't put the makeup on. We have to close the casket.
Oh,
so exactly what I'd been experiencing, I then heard several months later. And what it is, and I could not understand for myself why I would experience it. And it was very extreme for me. I was driving one of my best friends crazy. Like, she was actually having anxiety from what I was telling her, and I was having anxiety from what I was feeling because I couldn't actually see myself clearly. I felt I was a different person, but I didn't know it was her that I was picking up on until those words were said to me at the time that it was, you know, supposed to be an open casket for her. So, and it could not be. So anyway, as what happened is I feel that her death was inevitable, as in it was going to happen. Okay. So I felt that part of it. And I feel that I was experiencing it because there isn't time in the way that we understand it. So I feel like I was ahead in the time, living what she was going through as though she was going through it at that time, but from this point in time. And that's a really hard concept to grasp, but that's the only thing I can think of that happened. And the other thing that I came to find out, which I don't feel was written about, I was told this privately behind the scenes from somebody else, but what I was actually feeling with my leg and with an infection, that's actually one of the components that caused her passing. So I was actually getting the symptoms, pieces, bits and pieces. They sometimes do that from the other side. It does not come through as clearly as I'd like you to believe on every TV show where it's just like the person stands in front of you and boom, they're right there. And it's very obvious. It's bits and pieces, and it's like I'm a translator, and I have to actually analyze in my mind what I'm getting so that I know what I'm speaking, but yet I can't judge it, because if I judge it, I probably wouldn't say it because everybody would think I was crazy. So it's a tightrope you walk when you're in my position, from feeling it, experiencing it, and my body works that way. It goes from hearing things to feeling things to visually seeing things to me being in the middle of other people's thoughts, and back and forth. So that's kind of how it works for me. I don't always say it out loud, but my day is spent like that. So when I'm walking through a grocery store or whatever, I'm picking up on the other things around me and kind of moving through people's energy spaces is the best way I could describe it.
Sloan, my word, ever think to yourself, geez, I wish I'd gone into accounting?
Well, yeah, but I can't add, so I'd probably be in jail for that. I'd probably be in big trouble. You know, there were many things I've tried to do throughout my life. I wanted to do probably anything but what I'm doing. And no matter how much I sidetrack myself or step away from the work always follows me back. Like, it doesn't matter if I said I'm going to be a manicurist and I started to do that. People would inevitably ask me a question and I'd have to read them. It does not matter. Like, I find myself reading people. It's just, I guess it's what I'm supposed to be doing, so I do it. But I mean, if you said to me, hey, do you think you could do this? I'd probably try to run away and do it and then end up right back reading people doing that job, which is another interesting thing. A lot of people who are what I call psychically sensitive, they don't do it for a living. It's not their calling, but they have a gift. And sometimes it's a more developed gift than mine. It's just their ability. It's an open, huge ability. But let's say they are an accountant, and I actually do know a couple of accountants, weirdly, that have this ability. Let's say they are accountants, okay? People end up coming to them in their jobs, and they end up giving psychic advice through their work in their mainstream work. It's just they're not supposed to be known as doing that, but people find them anyway. They tell me this. So you can't really hide from it. It just exists. It's like you're being stalked by your purpose.
Stalked by your purpose. That's an interesting way of putting it. Your work in missing person cases, do you work directly with families, or do you work with law enforcement, or how does that happen?
I have done both. I've worked with police throughout my career. A lot of times when the police come to you, they come to you on their own, as in they are police people that know what you do, and so they seek your services privately, because the police department doesn't always like to say that they work with psychics, because I guess, you know, they don't want to be called crazy either. and it's a public service job, so then therefore it's a taxpayer money job, and I wonder if it has something to do with that. And at other times, the police, it depends what state you're in and how open the police chief is to whether they'll call you in. But I have been called. I have been called by, over the years, many different people, detectives, policemen, police women, asking me, you know, do you know any, they'll show me pictures. Detectives especially tend to be very open to it, but they get to see people who pass over and they're in the morgue quite a bit and they experience it. So they know there's something else outside of there, and they probably pick up on stuff themselves and just don't know how to put it in the context to the work that they're doing. But yeah, and I do get contacted by the family, especially when it comes to people that have underage children that are having issues, missing, exploited, kidnapped on drugs, that kind of thing. People call me all the time, and that's something I love to work with. So that's something that gives me, that's actually, that I feel is my purpose. So that's something that really makes me feel like I'm useful on the planet, to be able to help somebody in any capacity, whether it's just passing along information or actually helping them understand something that happened or why their child's experiencing what they're experiencing. I feel that's a very, I feel like that's a good use for the work that I do, because keep in mind, a lot of days that I work, my clients, when they come in, and it's as valid to every client who has a question, what their question is, whether they're asking about their dog, their boyfriend, their husband, their work, their inheritance. I don't care what the question, you know, the problem is. But for me, you know, does my boyfriend love me questions, although it's important to the person, I don't know actually if that's, I mean, I guess that's what the gift is for, but, or the ability, but to help somebody with their child, I feel like that's really the purpose of maybe why I have the ability.
Sure. But that, at the same time, in many, I don't know what the statistics are, but in many of these missing cases, usually, does it not end tragically?
Oh, yeah. Well, yes. The people, yeah, in a lot of the missing children cases, it is. They're kidnapped. They're taken out of the area. They're put into the sex trades and or murdered. There's a lot of times that we were just actually watching, you remember the Susan Smith story, I'm sure you remember that, but they had it on some TV show a couple of weeks ago, or I guess it's the anniversary, it might have been like 20 years or something, but I remember walking through the house, do you remember that story, the girl with the two babies and she drove them into the river?
Yes, yes.
The mother with the two babies, but she blamed it on a guy that kidnapped them. And I remember seeing her press conference and walking through and turning around in my living room saying she did it. Like, it was so obvious to me that she did it that I could just see it. I didn't need to hear anything she was saying. I didn't need to. It just was really, really jumping off of her body what she did. So at times I think we have, I don't know why as a society, all of us don't use our sixth sense. So our sense of clairvoyance, clairaudience, and our perception to really see what a person's saying. I don't know why it was shut down, but I think at one point in our development as people, we all had the ability to do it, and I don't know where it went and why it's coming back so differently at this point. But it was very obvious to me that she did it. Like, it didn't need to be logical. I didn't need to see facts. I just knew the woman did it. So, I mean, a lot of times you can tell when you're talking to the family members who knows what. It's very obvious when somebody knows something and they're not telling you about it, about a missing child, that kind of thing. So my goal is to give the detective or the family member asking the questions a different route with which to find clarity on their question about their child or the missing person.
It must be just heartbreaking, though. I mean, it must be absolutely heart-wrenching.
I think it pisses me off with young children the most. It bothers me with anybody, but in particular when they're small children, that really bothers me beyond. I can't even go there in my head. But when I'm reading the information, I'm not necessarily attached to it on an emotional level. I can't actually do that to myself. I've termed it in my life when people ask me to describe it. It's a transitory way of reading, as in I pop in and I pop out. So I'm extremely detached from it because if I become emotionally involved, I'm not going to want to tell the family member, the parent, the mother, the father, the detective, something that's going to upset them. And I'm aware of that. So I actually have to really detach myself to give the correct information because the human being I'm talking to has emotional needs, and I don't want to read like that because that will pull my energy into telling them more what they want to hear rather than what I actually pick up. So I try and have learned to really detach and to sort of pop in and pop out. So it's a transition energy I use when I'm reading so that I don't connect emotionally. That does not mean I don't go home and start, you know, cussing up a blue storm and becoming very upset. And sometimes it upsets me a lot where I can't stop thinking about the missing child. There was one kid, and I believe it's either in Oregon or Seattle, that little boy, I want to call him, I think his name was Chiron. Began with a K, cute little boy with glasses and blonde hair, probably 8 or 9 years ago that this happened, and they've never found him. I know he passed on. I saw somebody cross him over. And they believe it was the stepmother that did it, or the second wife. I guess she was the woman the father had an affair with, and then he married. They believe it was her, and I believe it was her, too. But I saw that the little boy had passed over, and it was really irritating to me because, for some reason, nobody can find his body. I can see where it is in my head, but I don't know logistically. Like, I can see it's in a marshy area. I want to say a marshy or water area. Do you know that case that I'm talking about? There's so many missing children.
Yeah, unfortunately, you're right. You nailed it. There are just too many. And unfortunately, I don't recall that specific case. Why don't we come back after the break, take some calls, and maybe we can reach out to some the spirit, do some spirit communication with loved ones. Would you be good for that, Sloan? Maybe she can't hear me. All right, we'll take a time out. The Temptations, taking us into the break with The Way You Do the Things You Do, right here on Coast to Coast AM.